Hey guys, thanks so much for tuning in to this week's edition of the Original Strength Podcast. This week's show is going to be about pushing the limits of human performance, and we have a very special guest, Mr. Martin Grubala, also known as the Honey Badger. And just so you know, just to give you a background on Martin, he is a professor of physics, chemistry, biophysics, and quantitative biology, but he is also an amazing man that has no limits. In fact, he's the honey badger. So, Martin, thanks so much for being on the show.
All right. Well, thanks for having me. And I guess I might as well start with the name since you just mentioned the honey badger. So I'm a member of a racing cycling club, the Wild Cards, in Champaign-Urbana, central Illinois. So that's where I'm located. That's kind of home base. It's great for cycle training. For training for ultra cycling, you know, super long distance races, because you've got this 15 mile an hour wind blowing, and then you just ride like 60 miles into the wind and then 60 miles back home with the wind and then call it a day or sometimes more. And, but in any case, the honey badger thing is, what happened is I went to Vietnam for a science lecture, and they took me to a cobra restaurant. So they actually serve cobra there, right? And they have them live in a cage or a basket. And you pick one out, and it actually got out of his hand and lashed out of me and got within inches of my face. And I did catch it on my cell phone. Of course, we always have to be ready, right, with the phone camera. And I sent this to my bike club. And then a few weeks later, I was doing what for a while became known as Ironman North Carolina. It was beach to battleship. It's one of those Ironman distance triathlons. And 10 miles into the bike ride, I crashed on a cone that had fallen over from cars, jamming into the cone from the other side of the street. And I was looking at my watch. Never look at your exercise watch. Anyway, so I ran over the cone and I landed on my chest. And as I found out later, I broke two ribs. But I just got back up and I took 4 ibuprofen that I had in my little bento bag on the bike and just finished the bike ride and then ran the marathon on the ribs and actually did a pretty good time. I considering I was running with broken ribs, it was 11:01 overall. Usually back then I was more like 10 something. And then I checked myself into the emergency room and they checked. And so after that, one of my friends from that bike club wrote a little poem that he sent by email. It says, Martin eats cobra. Martin falls down, breaks ribs. Martin gets back up. Martin gets... And so that was it. After that, everybody started calling me the honey badger. So I even made up a T-shirt that I wore during the Race Across America. And all my bicycle gear during the Race Across America had a honey badger on the back.
So you almost got bit by a cobra. I had no idea there were restaurants that serve cobra.
Yes. And actually, it was not defanged or devenomed because they don't usually come into close contact with the customers. So they're handled by people who know what they're, what they're doing. So, but yeah, that was an exciting moment.
That would be exciting for me as well. So you mentioned the Race Across America. What is that?
So the Race Across America is a really long ultra cycling race. It builds itself actually as the toughest bicycle race on the planet. We can argue about that, but it's definitely one of the toughest. It's hard. What it basically is you ride from Oceanside, north of San Diego, over to Annapolis, just east of Baltimore, and it's in a single stage. And so sleep is optional. You do whatever or not, as far as sleep is concerned. And needless to say, the people who tend to win, I won my age group in the 50 to 60 category at the race. And then I slept about 3 to 4 hours a day. So I was on the bike typically about between 19 and 36 hours nonstop, depending on the day. The open male category, the guys that are like in the 25 to 50 range, and they're mostly the people who win are in their late 20s or mid 30s, as you might expect, right? That's kind of where you really peak. they can get by on as little as 45 minutes of sleep a day. In fact, the year that I won the master's category at that race, I actually rode the same average speed and I spent the same amount of time on the bike as the race winner, but they only had to sleep for 45 minutes a day and I put in 3 to 4 hours. But, and I couldn't have, I mean, honestly, if I had tried to sleep 45 minutes a day, I wouldn't have made it through the race. I needed a little more than that. So it's tough. It has a very high average speed. So, you know, those 3,000 miles in, let's say, 10 days or something like that, you're talking about going, you know, typically between 12 and 16 miles an hour. Just to put that in perspective, at the Tour de France, which is actually shorter, it's maybe like 2,500 miles instead of 3,000. It has about the same climbing. You know, they have the Alps and all that, but you know, we have the Appalachians and we have the Rockies, of course, that you go through. But still, you know, at the Tour de France, you're riding a few hours a day and you sleep and eat and do all your stuff, right? At this race, you're just riding the whole time. So the average speed at race across America is about, you know, as I said, 12 to 16 miles an hour. At the Tour de France, it's 4.5 miles an hour because you have 23 days to do those stages, you know, that they do. And the rest of the time you rest, right? You're riding like 6 hours or 8 hours a day, not even that usually. And then you're free the rest of the day. So this is really what fascinates me about this race. It's that it's not like short peak efforts, like you do something for a couple of hours and then you're done with it. It's really trying to sustain an effort at a fairly high, at a high average pace, actually the highest average pace of any bicycling race over that kind of length of time in the world. And you just sustain that day after day, essentially without sleep.
So you rode a bicycle for 21 hours a day for almost for 10 days.
It took me 11 to finish.
Oh my
God. Winner did 9.5, the male open winner. And so the master's winner, I did it in 11. Yeah, it's just, you know, you get on the bike. And I had 3 cars. So it's like the Tour de France. I mean, there's like vehicles that accompany you and they feed you out of, you never stop, right? I'm just on that bike, literally, essentially almost the 21 hours a day. Twice a day, what we did is we had a crew change because the crew can't stay up 21 hours a day and do that day after day. So I had 3 cars and each would accompany me for about 6 to 7 hours, feed me out of the window. And then basically what we would do is we'd do a quick stop. I would change my bibs. Actually, one of the biggest reasons people quit in this race is because of infections in certain places. you know, you get saddle sores and things like that. But there are simple recipes to make sure that doesn't happen. You know, I'm a scientist, so I studied this all pretty carefully. And basically just using iodine solution to kill the bugs every 6 hours and switching to a new pair of cycling shorts so that you don't have all the sweat from 6 hours, whatever. So basically it was you ride for 6 or 7 hours, you're off the bike for 5 or 10 minutes, you change the bibs, you know, whatever, you get back on, the next crew is there, and then you go off with the next crew. You do that one more time, then you do that one last time, so you've done it 3 times a day, and then you stay at a motel 3 hours, you know, nap, get a little bit of sleep, jump right back in, just get back on the bike and do this again.
Oh my gosh. I was going to ask you if you use science to help you.
Yes. Actually, you don't have a choice to do that. This race has a really tough cutoff. So the fastest people in the world, so like the male open racers that are about 30 years old, you know, they can do it in about 8 days. But the race cutoff, actually, even in the 50 to 60 category, is 12 days. So that's basically 1.5 times that time. So this would basically be like saying that when you're running a marathon, right, the fastest 25 to 35 year old people in the world can do it in about 2 hours and 5 minutes. And so your cutoff is going to be 1.5 times that, right? And that's about, you know, 2 hours, and it's about 3 hours and 10 minutes, something like that, right? So, you know, if the Boston Marathon had a cutoff of 3 hours and 10 minutes, or any marathon had a cutoff of 3 hours and 10 minutes, there wouldn't be a whole lot of people finishing marathons, because marathons usually get 5 or 6 hours. Or take Ironman, right? Fast Ironman races, the world's best do in about 7:45 or something like that. Sometimes even a little bit faster. But you're given 17 hours to finish an Ironman race. So you can call yourself a finisher and do less than half the pace. Basically, the Ironman cutoff would have to be 10 hours and 45 minutes or something like that to be comparable to the cutoff at the race across America. And so not surprisingly, like the year that I did it, half of the people couldn't even finish. It's often at least one third to half of the people. And a lot of these ultra races do that, like the Badwater Ultra Marathon, right, which is kind of like a running race in that vein. You know, even with all the selection and everything, you know, it often has, you know, sometimes it gets up to 85% or even 90%. But in some years, like 2 years ago, it was 70% finishing rate. So people try and can't.
So you've done Badwater also.
Yeah, I did that next. So I figured, hey, you know, I won the Masters category at RAM, you know, the world's quote toughest bike race, and I'm certainly not going to win the Mayo Open, right? I'm too old for that. I'm too old, too slow at this point. And so I figured, okay, what to do next? And I figured, okay, what calls itself the world's toughest running race? Right? And again, we can argue there's lots of tough running races out there. You know, the Spartathlon, marathons in the Sahara and all kinds of, you know, good stuff. But this is a tough one. And Badwater, particularly for someone like me, is tough. And the reason is I do sweat. And I sweat a lot. And I sweat actually more at high temperatures than I really need to, right? You need to sweat. Otherwise, you know, you can't really exercise at high performance because it's that evaporative cooling from the water on your skin surface that really contributes a lot to your cooling. Right? So your heart rate goes up. There is basically more heat flow from your core to the surface, you know, through your capillaries. And then that heat gets dumped by evaporatively going away with the evaporation of the sweat. So when the sweat evaporates, it basically, you need to put energy into those water molecules to rip them apart to make a gas, right? Because the liquid goes into a gas from your skin surface, and that carries away the heat from your skin. Okay, so this works great if you're at a temperature below 97 degrees Fahrenheit, which is your body temperature, right? And that's the temperature that the water is at when it sits on your skin. But, you know, at Badwater, so actually maybe I should say a little bit about it. Badwater is a running race that starts out in Death Valley at Badwater, which is the lowest point in the U.S. It frequently has daytime temperatures in the 120 to 130 degrees Fahrenheit region in July. And the race, of course, is in July. I mean, for the same reason they put RAM, the bicycle race, in June, right? So they want it at the hottest time in the desert of the year because it's supposed to be a real test of endurance. And so then this race is 135 miles. It used to be actually 148 all the way to the summit of Mount Whitney, but it's difficult to get park service permits all the way to the top. So they changed it just to go to the gate at 8,000 feet, basically on Mount Whitney. So the first part of this race is you run 100 miles through a 125 degree desert. And at night, then it's only 117. and then you climb a total of 14,000 feet, including the final 8,000 feet to get up, you know, to the Mount Whitney portal. And so basically the idea in this race is that you're just dehydrating yourself and killing yourself at 120 plus degree temperatures for, you know, whatever, anywhere between 20 something and up to 48 hours they actually give you in this race. I finished in third place in my age group last year in 37 hours and change, and that's considered a pretty good, you know, average finish. But the idea is basically you exhaust yourself and you sweat yourself to death at 125 degrees, and then you start mountain climbing for another 30 miles, you know, after that, just to, you know, for fun at the end. And so for me, this was hard. And I tried this race in 2018. It's actually amazing that Chris Costin, who organizes this, let me in, because I had only a year and a half of ultra running experience. Like most of the people that do this race, I mean, they're people who have done 50, 100 mile runs or whatever. You know, like you look at the resumes and it's like, oh. I did RAM, right? And then I started ultra running. So I did my first 50 mile, my first ultra run in October of 2016, after I finished RAM a few months later. I needed to, RAM takes a while to recover. I didn't do much between July and October. I did the USAT, the USA Triathlon National Championship in between in August, but that was it kind of for for a race is, that's short. It's like, you know, it's like an Olympic, so it's like a 2 hour, you know, race. But then, so I did my first 50 miler and it went pretty well. So I did another one 3 weeks later and that went pretty well. I got faster. And so then I signed up for my first 100 miler in November, just like a month later, because I figured, hey, you know, if I can do 250 milers, you know, in a month in a row, maybe I can go, I don't know. And that also went well. I did a sub 20 immediately at my first 100 miler. Usually people are pretty happy if they do sub 24 hour runs, because the 100 milers are mostly trail races, right? So they're on some kind of a trail, it's somewhat irregular, you're running in the night when you can't really see. You need to pay attention, otherwise you face plant.
Right.
And so you've got to be careful there. So I got into this, and then I thought, oh, things are going so well. Why not just look up what is a really tough, you know, long distance running race? And so that's how I found Badwater. And so I signed up for it, and I failed miserably in 2018. So I did it twice, right? I tried in 2018, and I succeeded in 2019 last year. I was really naive in 2018. I thought, you know, you run a couple of 100 miles here or there and do pretty well in them, and you can run sub 20. And eventually I got down to 18 hours and below. You know, this shouldn't be a problem. Well, I changed my mind actually the moment I opened the car door in Death Valley when I first got out of our air-conditioned vehicle, because even training at 100 degrees almost, or 100 degree plus heat index in Illinois, you know, it can easily get 95 degrees and 105 index. It's just nothing by comparison. I mean, the Death Valley is a thing totally all its own that one has to understand and come to learn. And so what happened to me is I did some heat acclimatization training in 2017, 2018. But my idea was to run out at 95 degrees in Illinois and to sit in the sauna maybe once a week or so and do some sauna, because people told me they were doing sauna. And little did I know that was utterly inadequate for actually surviving at that water. So what happened the first year I did it is I would run, and every 2 miles, so about every 20 minutes, because at that temperature, at 125 degrees, I can't run faster than 10-minute miles. And I'd be running, and then my crew would stop me and check, did I drink my water or whatever? And I had drank my entire container of water, like 25, 30 ounces, but my weight had gone down by a pound in 2 miles. So then, you know, I would run another 2 miles, and I would drink my container of water, and my weight now was down a kilogram, so, you know, over 2 pounds. And this kept going until basically at about, you know, after whatever, 10, 15 hours, I'm, you know, just keep running through the night. The race, by the way, starts at 8 p.m. So you've already had a sleepless, so you've had a full day, and then you have it starts with a sleepless night and then goes to other sleepless nights, you know, from there. So to make it a little harder. But basically, by the time I got to, you know, close to 50 miles, I had lost like 11 pounds or something like that of body weight.
Oh my goodness.
And I was basically doing 1 mile an hour. I could just slowly slump. That's all I could do at that level of, you know, 5 or 6% dehydration. And I drank. That wasn't the problem. I was sweating 80 ounces an hour and drinking 30, so I was losing 50. Or whatever. Yeah, so that was just it. And eventually a race official came by and said, sir, do you know that the cutoff for 50 miles at the 2,000 foot elevation sign is at 10 a.m. and it is now 10:20 and you're still, you know, 2.5 miles away. So I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to collect your chip. They had chips that year. They gave that up again the following year. So then I talked to some people who really know what they're doing. A nice lady, Pam, who is actually the world champion in the female 60 age group. She explained to me what real sauna training actually is. And so then I did that the following year. And so my training in the following year consisted of maybe running 50 to 100 miles a week at 95 degrees outdoors, but that's nothing. So again, I did that the year before. That doesn't prepare you for that work. But then in the evenings, I went to the local Y, and I convinced them to actually change their sauna over into a dry sauna, so not put water in there, and raise the temperature to 190 to 200 Fahrenheit. And so then I would sit in that sauna at 190 Fahrenheit. Initially, I couldn't take more than 10 minutes of it. It's like a fight and flight reflex. You just want to get out of there. But then I managed to build it up to 50 minutes. So I would do 5 days a week, eventually up to 50 minutes at 180 to 200 degrees. And it made an incredible difference. So what I would do is I would weigh myself before and after to measure my sweat loss. And during that time, my sweat loss declined at that temperature from about 80 ounces per hour to 30 ounces per hour. And 30 ounces per hour, you know, it's like a big bike bottle. You know, you could actually drink that in an hour. Right? And look, I went to Badwater in 2019, same crew, you know, same race. The temperature was a little lower by 2 or 3 degrees, but still it was in the 125, you know, range. And no problem. I drank my drink and I weighed the same after 2 miles. I drank my drink and I weighed the same. And I weighed the same minus 3 or 4 pounds because of the fat loss. So you're losing about 4 pounds of fat while you run that race. And I was exactly on target. My weight loss was exactly what you expect from the fat calories that had to be burned to finish that race.
So,
and that was it.
So let me get this straight. So through exposing your body to a sauna that was about 200 degrees Fahrenheit, you taught your body how to sweat less through the acclimation of doing that?
That's right, the acclimation of doing that. And also, you again, if you look at the medical literature, the capillary formation improves. So you do actually get also better heat transfer from your blood, from the core to the surface in addition. The effect doesn't last very long, by the way. So heat training, it takes about 3 weeks to get to the maximum, according to medical studies. And that also fitted my, you know, I sort of measured my heart rate and my weight every day. And then it takes about 3 weeks to disappear again. So you really have to do this before. It's not like you can do this and then for life you're heat trained. So like right now, if I tried to do Badwater today, I'd be 1 pound down in an hour, another pound. It would be basically, I'm sure, the same story again. And the heart rate also goes down. So that takes less time. It takes about a week, and there have been medical studies on that. When I went to Badwater the first time, I got out of the car, and I'm standing there, and it's 118 degrees at night, you know, when the race starts. And my heart rate is 125 beats per minute standing there, right? I'm not, my resting heart rate normally when I'm lying in the morning, I'm just checking, it's 38 beats per minute. So this is bad. This is like a 90 beat per minute higher resting heart. That's higher than most people's, you know. Anyway, so it was higher. That was also part of the reason, because then you start running, right? Your heart rate goes to 160 or something. And then you're toast after a while. You can't sustain it. When I came back in 2019, my resting heart rate was 60 beats per minute. Still, you know, almost twice as high as my real normal resting heart rate. But there was a lot more headroom there between, you know,
right,
the heart rate I needed to run at and the heart rate that I had when I was just basically standing there in the heat.
So how do you, you've done a 3,000 mile bike ride and you've done a 135 mile run and through Death Valley. Other than the heat training, how do you prepare your body to do those things?
So training is very important. And I mean, so I'm going to preach some of the things that I've heard from you, right? Because you do preach them and they are actually true. I mean, one of the most important things is rest. So, you know, if you just train, eventually you're just going to burn out. And so I actually did have a lot of rest periods during my training cycles. And the way it worked out for me is, as a scientist, I do just a lot of traveling where I give lectures. Not for the last 3 months, right, with COVID-19, but normal. And so there's actually lots of times when I'm flying around or I'm at hotels and whatever. And rather than desperately trying to get on the, in the workout room and run on the treadmill at the hotel or stuff like that, I basically just said, you know, I've got 3 days at this place. I'm flying in. I'm giving a talk. I'm just going to have their big dinners that they serve you at the, you know, and I'm just going to give my talk and that's it. And I'm just going to take off for 3 days. So I had plenty of these kinds of, you know, little periods in between, you know, where I just got total rest. In between those periods, though, I do work out a lot. So I exercise a lot. So a typical session, I do basically cycling, swimming, running, and then weightlifting with, you know, warm downs that involve, you know, OS kind of things, you know, to sort of, you know, get the body kind of still with some exercise, you know, breathing exercises, rolling exercises, things like this, you know, all the way down to, you know, to equilibrium again. And so, you know, a typical week might be something like, I might do a 200 mile bike ride on Saturday, and then run 30 miles on Sunday because I have time, you know, more time on the weekend. And a lot of ultra runners, by the way, do like back-to-back 30-mile runs. And I find that not very helpful because that kind of destroys me doing that twice in a row. So I do, as I said, like 100 to 200-mile bike ride, which is much gentler on the legs than running. And then I do the 30-mile run the following day. But you're tired aerobically and in every way from the cycling. So that would be like the weekend. And then on Monday, after this really extensive exercise, I'll do aerobic weightlifting. So a lot of it is self-supported weight, like pulling myself up on the door jamb, you know, to do pull-ups and chin-ups, things like this, you know, push-ups, a lot of squatting. If I use weights, I use very light weights. I mean, we're literally talking like, you know, 5 to 10 pounds per hand or something. That's it. You know, I don't go more than that. But I'll do a lot of reps. So, you know, in an hour, I think my record is I've gotten in 1,500 reps in an hour. Something like that.
Oh my goodness.
that's doing a lot of reps. And then at the end of this exercise, I will basically go through, you know, Sarah, you know her well, right? She's basically my coach that talks common sense into me. So I talk to her about, you know, when things get out of hand. And she's of course an OS, you know, person also. And so she's given me a lot of tips on breathing exercises. I like the frog roll a lot at the end of my workouts. And the reason is, it's actually still a real workout, but it kind of gets you down, you know, back down to baseline from doing like 500 reps of something. And it exercises the whole body, right? Because you're really getting up and you're sort of juggling your leg and arm on one side and then rolling over, and then you're doing it again on the other side, and you sort of rock back and forth between those two positions. And I feel like everything, my back, my neck, my legs, my upper and lower leg, my arms, everything actually gets a workout, but not at the intensity level that, you know, if you're doing weightlifting. And so I do that for a while. And then basically breathing exercises at the end. I might be on my all fours and, you know, just taking some deep breaths. And eventually I just get down on my back and just lie down flat on the back and do a, you know, breathing on my back. And then I'm done and I've cooled down. So that's the Monday. And then on Tuesday, I might do like a marathon. On a Wednesday, I might do a 50-mile bike ride with the group, you know, the wild cards that I mentioned. On Thursday, I might do another marathon, or if I feel a little tired, maybe just a half marathon. And then on Friday, same thing again, right, to get ready for doing the what's coming on Saturday and Sunday, I'll tend to do a second session of aerobic weightlifting, and that gets me an hour of exercise, but without really, you know, I still recover while I'm doing that. And then, as I said, pretty much every 2 weeks or so, I have like 3 days off and I'm traveling or doing something else. And I do take those days just off. No regrets.
How many miles do you think you cover in a week?
So the record I've done in a month, so I'll give it to you in terms of cycling mileage. And for running mileage, you should divide that by three, because like cycling 60 miles, that's about 3 hours. And running 20 miles, you know, if you're not running too fast, that's also about 3 hours. And so I've peaked at 3,000 miles a month. So that would be like 800 miles a week. But I would say a more typical week is maybe 200 to 300 miles.
All right.
So in other words, 70 to 100 miles of running or 200 to 300 miles of cycling.
That's amazing. I got to ask you, first two questions. How much do you weigh?
When I'm not race weight, I'm at about 145 pounds, and at race weight, I'm at about 142. Not a very big difference.
How many calories do you eat a day?
I eat a lot. So my wife is from Greece, and so she cooks the Mediterranean cuisine. So it's all olive oil and tomato-based sauces and things like this. I am a meatarian, I confess, you know, so, but actually a lot of it is based on okra and aubergines, or eggplant, I guess they call it in the US, and, you know, all kinds of vegetables and foods of that sort. And so that's really the base of that cuisine. And, it depends on the training day, but I typically try to put in anywhere between 3,000 to 5,000 calories to maintain my weight. And if I don't, of course, actually it's kind of funny. So when I'm not working out, right, I'm going on these trips to conferences. They're taking me to these nice restaurants. And of course, these are restaurants that have like 2000 calorie dinners, right? But, you know, I ate a granola breakfast that day, and the lunch was also some small thing with the grad students or whatever at the university. And so I'm eating the $2,000 dinner. But for me, that's actually like a major drop in the calories. While they're all complaining, like, my God, you know, look at this, it says, because the menus nowadays have calories on them.
Right.
Like, the entree is 1200 calories and the cake for dessert is 800 calories. Right? And I'm going like, yep, that's about half of what I usually eat. No problem.
And you're like, I want two main dishes and two desserts, please.
I'll, exactly. I'll, exactly. And you're, can I have your leftovers? So, yep.
So, all right. So you've done all these amazing things. How do you train your mindset to do these things? How do you set your mind?
Yes. So that's, to be completely honest with you, actually, that's more important than the physical training. I would say the mind rest and the rest. So the mind, the frame of mind and the rest are actually really the most important things, even though it sounds like he's just training. It's those 2 days a week when I just do light weightlifting and the days when I don't do anything that make it work in the end, otherwise I'd be overtrained. So for the mind, I accustom myself to it by doing the running and bicycling under conditions that are mentally tough every time I do it. So to give you a good example, for instance, I did a session a couple of months ago where I just did 14 half marathons in 14 days, just one half marathon a day. I couldn't do a marathon a day for 14 days. That would really kill me. But 14 half marathons a day, that's kind of, okay. But that wasn't the big part. The bad part was I did this these marathons or half marathons on the same truck-ridden shoulder of a state freeway, basically just running, you know, 6.5 miles down and whatever, 6.5 miles back up, the exact same one every day under the same conditions. So it's just, it's that same. At the end, I could actually, I'm running along and I could go, there's the tissue that somebody discovered 3 days ago. And that means it's only another minute or so before I get to the plastic dragon wing from a toy that somebody threw out the car window, right? So you get to know the terrain at that kind of level. And you're just one with it. It's like a Zen thing. You know, I run along and I look at the white stripes they paint on the freeway, and I actually know the pattern. So I know at what part of the run there will be like 3 paint strokes versus 7 paint strokes from the, you know, little painting machine that they use. And I call it the lizard brain. But I'm a scientist, so actually my job consists of like thinking all day and solving analytical problems and doing this kind of stuff, you know, 12 hours a day. So actually I find it very zen to just run and for an hour and a half count how many strips there are in the paint on the side of the road. Other things that I've done, but that's cheating, and so that's not the mental training, is I've taken like, you know, as part of the science, I need to edit journals. And when you edit journals, you have to read the articles that people write. So actually, instead of reading them, I would record them and then just have them, a PDF player, you know, play the vocal, the sound, you know, read the recording for me, basically. And I would just do that while cycling and just listen to the article. So I got work done while writing. But that's not fair, because then your mind is distracted and that makes it a lot easier. And many races actually don't allow headphones or things like this, like the Spartathlon is an example where you have to get through your 150 miles and because it's on roads, they make you do it without headphones. So basically I would say I actually seek out monotony and I actually have learned to enjoy it. So I used to hate it. It's like, man, God, you have to drag me out there to run. I used to love running like with groups of people and I like cycling with groups of people. But I've gotten used to the idea. I look at running as meditation now. So you run, you focus on something simple like the dimples, you know, those little dimples they do so the cars make a noise when they go over the dimples. And you just count those into the thousands or 10,000s or you look at the stripes on the side of the road. And it puts you in this very weird frame of mind where you almost have an out-of-body experience while you're running. So I almost feel sometimes when I'm deep into the run that I'm actually watching myself on this road from above. Well, I'm kind of like just, you know, like an ant kind of running around on this strip. And it puts you in this weird meditative frame of mind where time just passes. I mean, I've done runs, obviously, honestly, where I'm running. And suddenly I'm home and I'm going like, okay, I've done 31 miles. I'm done with my 50K for the day. And I didn't even realize that a whole lot of time has passed. And when you can get yourself into that frame of mind, these races aren't that bad, right? Because you're running and you're at the finish line, right? I mean, actually, Badwater felt like that. There were really only three stops for me in Badwater. I was running to a little town called Panamint, and there my crew did a little rest stop for me. And then I ran to the exit of Death Valley, National Park. And there my crew did some longer thing for me, like 45 minutes. And so that sort of registered. And then I did the rest. And actually, when I think of the race, it almost seems like I'm at the start and suddenly I'm in Panamint and my crew is doing stuff. And then I get going again and suddenly I'm at the Death Valley exit sign. And then my crew does some more stuff and boy, suddenly I'm at the finish line up on the mountain. So that's kind of how the memory almost feels after the race.
You may really be above your body watching your body run. It sounds like you are having
maybe I have an out of body experience. I don't know, but that's definitely how it feels. And anyway, but getting yourself into that kind of a frame of mind that's purely meditative and where you're not trying to worry about your daily worries or even doing science or anything like that. As I said, I call it the lizard brain, because I'm really just thinking of the grass on the ground or the stripes on the road or whatever. That's what actually makes it then pretty easy for me to get through long distances mentally. And there's also no time. The other thing is, even if you're feeling miserable, when you're focusing on the stripe on the road and that's all that's in your mind, you don't even realize you're miserable because you do feel miserable in these races. Right? By the time you're at mile 90 of a 100-mile run or you're at mile 2,000 of a 3,000-mile bicycle race, you are miserable. I mean, everything is hurting, right? Your butt is hurting on the bike. Your legs are hurting on the run. Your neck is hurting. But you kind of can just blend that out.
That's amazing. That is amazing. It does sound very, that sounds very mystical almost the way you describe it.
I'm a strong proponent. I actually believe, and this may not be true, right? I mean, because I haven't had both experiences. I've never really done meditation or things like that in any kind of explicit way. But I think actually that kind of running and actually gets you probably into the same state. So I don't know if I'm in the same state of mind as a Buddhist monk, while they're deep in a meditation. But I could actually imagine that it's at least a closely related state of mind.
So I read some of those accounts, and based off of what you said, I would say that I think you are pretty much close to the same state.
Yeah, probably it's that kind of a state of mind. So if that's true, then I would say, hey, okay, so here's my tip for mental preparation, right? Get yourself into that state of mind where monotony is actually your friend, and it actually allows you to relax your mind while you're doing whatever it is you're doing. And then it'll be much easier to get through that, even if it's really long and even if it's painful.
That is awesome. Martin, this has been really, this is very enlightening. I mean, that's funny. But just know, the things you have been able to do, how you've been able to push your body, how you've been able to acclimate your body, I think you're the example of there really are no limits to what a person can do.
Yeah, if you're willing to push yourself and if you're willing to suffer a little bit of pain, and it's true in a lot of sports, right? I mean, there's, mountain climbing is another good one, right? I think there must be a Zen element in it. And I've never done it, but actually I'm getting increasingly interested in it. So
who knows? That's coming.
That might be coming. Another one that I know is coming for me is, after the, I started out in triathlons and doing Ironman races. I did the, my last one, and that kind of was my good bike, was the Ironman Hawaii in October last year. But at some point, that was Ironman number 22. I got to a point where I know how to do them now, right? And there isn't really there is no fear of failure or anything really at that point anymore. Whereas at Badwater or races like that, there is fear of, I wouldn't even say fear, maybe that's not the right word, there is actually looking forward to the possibility of failure, let's put it that way, because that's what makes it interesting, right? If you're not really sure whether you can even do this or not. Those are the kinds of races I now like to sign up for, I'm not totally sure whether this is going to work or not. Probably a year and a half at least preparation. Weight gain, for a swimmer, actually, it's not that good of an idea to be all the way down to that low weight. So we'll see what happens. You know, I think I'll give it a try. I know Lynn Cox. She is like one of the world's top open water swimmers. I would maybe even say she's the open water swimming legend. And she actually, nicely enough, answers my questions when I ask her questions, because she's definitely the world's expert. And so I think eventually I'm going to have to break down and do the British Channel swim or something, you know, like that. I think that'll be interesting.
I think your adventures are just getting started, it sounds like.
Yeah. Well, as long as I can keep doing it, I'm getting close to 60. So, you know, hey, who says, you know, that's right. Who cares? Exactly. So,
well, Martin, thank you so much for taking your time and doing the show with me. I really appreciate it. This has been fascinating.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for having me on the show. And
guys, thanks so much for tuning into this week's edition of the Original Strength Podcast with Martin, the Honey Badger, Grubala. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this edition of the Original Strength Podcast.